As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keane, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Paul, I want you to bring in Dan Ives, but let me give you some pre-COVID comparisons. Pre-COVID, $126 billion revenue. 126 has become 243.
Wow.
Okay. EBITDA, down the income statement, throwing some balance sheet joy that only Dan Ives understands. $56 billion pre-COVID. They've done terrible. It's $125 billion now. They've done on the edge of a double.
Yeah.
A triple. And then let me just get down to what I care about. Ives doesn't care about free cash flow. Free cash flow, $38 billion. It's basically a double pre-COVID to where we are. This company is failing. Why don't you bring in the good guy from Wedbush?
Our good friend Dan Ives, Wedbush Securities Senior Equity Analyst. So, Dan, we got a good look at a couple of the real stalwarts in the tech space last night. Microsoft. And Alphabet, I know you don't cover Alphabet, but I know you've got some thoughts there. But let's just start with Microsoft there. Our good friends in Seattle, it seemed like a solid quarter across the board here. I know the stocks reflected that over the last year. What did you take away from our good friends at Microsoft?
I mean, look, I think they should print this press release off and conference call and put it in the loop. I mean, if you look, the cloud numbers here are off the charts. Copilot, remember, this is all about AI. Copilot, you have over a million customers right now from a subscriber perspective. Enterprise are lining up. Monetization's here. This is just the start of the revolution. Right. I think this is as bullish as we could have expected.
Dan Ives, go out 3 years. I was talking with our great Joel Levington this morning about, you know, the timeline out. I want you to be an adult. I don't care about the next trading day. I don't even care how we get Microsoft to Valentine's Day. Give me 2026. Where is this juggernaut then?
I think it's somewhere between 4 to 5 trillion. I mean, but Tom, we'll just put some numbers around it.
Please.
There's an incremental 100 to 125 billion of cloud revenue, not reflected in street numbers. If you put that into EPS, I mean, you're really essentially looking at what could be an incremental $3 to $4 of EPS. That's not reflected in the stock.
Yeah, well, I was on the conference call and I said to Satya, I said, don't get rid of Diablo 4. But you know, tell me about Activision, because I looked at the free cash flow explosion. And everybody's been out of shape about the revenue of Activision. I'm looking at the profit from day one. It's larger than what we would call Windows business. What does profit at Activision do out 2 years, 3 years?
Well, I think it's really about the cross-sell opportunity. I mean, that's something that probably could increase another 20, 25% for me. From a profitability perspective, that's just going to give them more and more of a tailwind, because in the scheme of things, it's a rounding error, you know, relative to the overall business. But right. What they're doing now, they're just broadening out on the consumer and on the enterprise, gaining more and more strength. And you look at the numbers are just, they're jaw-dropping.
They're truly, folks, from the scope and scale of this.
Yep.
To me, it's the Rockefeller buildup back in the 1890s to 1920. Paul, LinkedIn
up 9%.
I know. It's just amazing. Hey, Dan, I know you don't cover Alphabet per se, but what do you think, you know, this just AI and ChatGPT for our friends in Seattle, what does that mean for kind of the global search business?
Well, I think, look, if you look at Alphabet, the advertising, even though, you know, some could sort of split hairs here, I think actually really strong. We saw from YouTube and a lot of their assets. I think the big thing on Alphabet is just what's happened in Google Cloud. You look at that, some of the parts, I mean, they're just starting to tap into that massive opportunity in the cloud. And we've talked about, well, my colleague Scott Devitt, that could add $30 to $40 per share to the Google right. store.
And I was just real simple here. Apple tomorrow, Amazon tomorrow. What do you expect?
Look, New York City cab drivers bearish on Apple, you know, in terms of units and everything. And I think China's actually been relatively stable. I think that's going to be a breath of fresh air from Cook and Cupertino on units, on services. And on Amazon, and the big story is going to be the I'll call it a mini turnaround that they're seeing on e-commerce as well as cloud. We're going to look at the end of this week and say big tech's delivering. These knee-jerk reactions I view as kind of table scraps.
All right, Dan. So, I mean, I think, you know, the big thing for Apple is China. So just give us a sense how you think that's going to be play out, or how you think Tim Cook's going to frame that out tomorrow night.
I think he's going to talk about demand's been relatively stable. There are some pockets of weakness, Huawei competition, but overall the upgrade opportunities in the ASPs look strong in the region. I mean, it's our view that units show growth this year. The street's now baking in, I'd say, 5 to 10% decline. So if you start to hear that from Cook, along with services double-digit growth, you look what's happened to free cash flow, Keen always talks about. I mean, you start to now get a stock that should be closer to 250 rather than, you know,
right.
180.
I got 30 seconds, Dan Ives. Use of cash. When do they get off their butt? Sweeney wants them to raise a dividend. He sent a note out there this morning to Amy Hood. They got to raise a dividend, share buyback, bond issuance. When does Microsoft grow up and act like a blue chip?
Yeah, and they talked about that Sweeney activist situation. And I think that's something over the next 6-12 months, there's going to be some massive deployment of capital allocation, just given they're generating more cash in some countries
right.
here.
You know, this just came in. Rich from the Netherlands just emailed in, you know, middle of the day. That's a hell of a man cave on YouTube, folks. You got the Ives Sports Man Cave. What do you got in the paraphernalia behind you there?
Well, we got our, of course, Penn State. We are Giants, Islanders. Got my Bon Jovi stuff.
You got your
there.
Bon Jovi? Is it early Bon Jovi back with the skull t-shirts? Or is it
it's
later Bon Jovi? Suburban
we're
music.
We're talking 85 core.
Okay, nice. When Michael Brower mixed it. That's good. Dan Ives there on John Bon Jovi. Thank you so much. Good morning, Michael Brower, who mixed all those great hits. Right now on the Fed, she won't fly Boeing anymore. Julia Coronado joins us. Macro policy perspectives here on Fed Day. Julia, I'm going to posit the same question, which I think is the ambiguity of what to do with a nominal rate where it is. And that, folks, the math here is the yield of, pick your duration, the 10-year minus a new wicked small inflation, a disinflationary statistic, which gives you a high real yield. Julia, how should the Fed respond to where the nominal, the current 10-year real yield is?
Well, I think that the Fed trade-off ahead of them. They can not be in a rush. At the same time, there's no denying now that the inflation trend is definitely outpacing their expectations. And a sequence of cuts to the nominal rate is the right way to balance risks to keep that real yield from tightening. So I think the direction of travel is pretty clear. And what we will look to hear from Jay Powell is some sense of strategy and timing and cadence.
Right.
And again, what exactly they're looking at to trigger this process.
Are they slaves to the Greenspan measured, which I think everybody knows from listening to me for years, I totally disagree with my good friend Dr. Greenspan on, but are they just completely slaves to at all costs be measured?
I don't think so. I would say it's a little bit more nuanced. They did say that they could move methodically, or that's what Governor Waller signaled, and we'll see if Chair Powell repeats that word today. What is methodical? Well, it sort of suggests they won't be moving in, you know, 50 or 75 basis point moves, that they will be moving in 25 basis point increments. But I expect a lot less sort of rigid forward guidance. That doesn't mean 25 basis points every meeting or, you know, every other meeting. It's going to be dependent on the data. It could be faster or slower, but it does seem like they are ruling out chunkier moves in the initial phases of this process. Again, as long as the economy cooperates, if we get, you know, companies laying off workers, certainly that would change the landscape and they could move a lot faster. But I think in the current environment where the labor market looks pretty healthy, a lot cooler, but pretty healthy, growth is fine and inflation is cooling quite rapidly, the intention seems to be, dare I say, move at a measured pace.
And Julia, but there's a lot of folks out there, a lot of folks that, you know, look at real-time data and say, hey, this Fed, inflation's already down, the economy is slowing, mm-hmm. now is the time. Why yes. wait to see the rearview mirror data confirm what we already know, which is the economy is slowing, inflation is tame, let's go now.
Yeah, it's a fine balance. You know, again, you're right. We look at Q4 GDP. It's quite impressive. But again, that's Q4. We're in Q1 and we're looking towards Q2. What does the future hold? I think we've seen surveys showing some, you know, alarming things on the hiring front. We, in our own scraping of earnings reports that we do at MPP, we're hearing the same thing, that there's not a lot of hiring intentions. So we could see a cooling in the labor market in coming months. I don't necessarily think it'll show up on Friday because there's some seasonality issues that could boost the number. But I do think in coming months, we're going to see softer job numbers. And that could lead the Fed to go either at a steadier pace. I do expect them to move in March. I don't see there's a reason holding them back. We expect, as long as the January inflation data don't repeat the surge that we saw last January, if it looks more like the last 6 months, which is very benign, I think that they go ahead in March and get this process started. I think that's what we've been hearing in Fed speak. When they say risks are balanced, that means, you know, it's time to start thinking about the next phase of policy.
Hey, Julia, you mentioned kind of the labor market, and obviously we'll get a good read on Friday here. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I took two economics classes at Duke. I feel qualified to comment on this. I'm just shocked at how strong the labor market has been and how resilient the labor market's been. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's been impressive. It was the main reason we did not expect a recession last year. The U.S. labor market is so diversified. It's an ocean liner. And we came into last year just firing on all cylinders. And it was hard to see a sharp turn down. It's a little bit, I would agree, it is with the Fed, it's more balanced now. Hiring still looks okay, but it's slowed considerably since last year. Unemployment is low,
right?
But it's crept up a little bit. And the base of hiring, the number of companies hiring, the number of sectors hiring has really, really narrowed.
Steve Rattner.
It's just three sectors driving everything.
Steve Rattner was out the other day. He's doing a thing on Morning Joe. He's like chart guy on Morning Joe.
I know, I saw that.
Steve's got a killer chart, killer chart, showing how odd the employment growth was, this explosion out of a stimulus-led pandemic. Dr. Coronado, who benefited in the job market? Was it the haves, the have-nots? Did the middle class lift?
Yes. I mean, I think one of the great things we saw from this run it hot experiment was that it did benefit the lower end of the earnings spectrum. And that's something we haven't seen in decades. But the lower income workers, you know, it was Amazon competing with Chipotle for, you know, entry level, lower wage workers. And all of a sudden, those workers could get full time jobs with benefits at a decent wage. That was a, it was like a level shift up for the lowest earners. Now, at the top, it's a bit more nuanced. Things like work from home allow, actually, people are not willing, they're willing to take smaller raises for more flexibility. And so actually, like, supervisory workers didn't get those raises.
Julia Coronado, thank you so much for the Fed brief.
Flexibility. Do we have flexibility?
We have flexibility.
Okay.
I've waited and waited for this interview. Robert D. Kaplan, I've done a number of books with him where they've been my book of the summer. He did a brilliant book on China and all their expansion, if you will, off of Marco Polo. His definitive book on the South China Sea is a must-read for anyone in the American military to get an understanding of the circuitous nature of the South China Sea. And, of course, the way the United States military is expanding in the Philippines is just one example right now. And without question, my book of the year this year was Robert D. Kaplan, The Loom of Time. Yes, it's Between Empire and Anarchy from the Mediterranean to China. Baloney. It's a primer from Morocco all over to the stands where you don't know they're on the map. Robert D. Kaplan joins us right now on international relations. Robert D. Kaplan, if you wrote The Loom of Time right now, how would you have to rewrite it after Mr. Netanyahu's actions in Israel?
First of all, it's a pleasure to be with you, Tom. I would not have to rewrite it at all, because Israel and Palestine are really not in the loom of time. And what I did do in the loom of time was I said that ultimately the Middle East will change dramatically with a change of regime in Iran that will be driven by internal factors, and that I think the events of October 7th, 2023 because of their very ferocity and bestiality and intimacy, have probably changed the Israeli calculation on Iran, that sometime in the future we're going to see direct Israeli attacks on Iran, not now because they have their hands full with Gaza,
right?
And that Iran, you know, that it, as when Iran changes, where 85 million Iranians are brought into the global economy, that's when the Middle East will really shift.
James Stravitis was on yesterday, the former Supreme Commander NATO. He was fiery, incendiary, about that we need to take actions against Iran. You're one of our experts on what we've gotten right, what we've gotten wrong, about the cultural Sunni-Shia debate, the idea that Iran has maybe the only legitimate middle class in the pan-Arab world. What is the Robert Kaplan prescription for how we approach Iran after three deaths in Jordan?
Well, first of all, keep in mind that we had the United States and especially Israel have been in an undeclared war with Iran for years now. And it really ramped up after October 7th and ramped up another degree or two after the three deaths at the U.S. military base in northeastern Jordan. I think the way they have to approach it is, everyone says, let's take out their nuclear facilities or their missile facilities. This is easier said than done. A lot of their nuclear facilities are deep underground. I don't think the Israelis have the equipment, the bunker buster bombs to do it. I think that what the Biden administration has to do is increase by degrees its retaliation. In other words, not tit for tat. And the reason why tit for tat doesn't work anymore is because the Iranian strategy is they will have their proxies attack Americans and Israelis, and the Americans and Israelis will then attack their proxies without hitting Iran directly. Therefore, Iran suffers no retribution. And because Iran is afraid of a dramatic retribution against them, because that could unhinge the domestic situation in Iran, which has been tense for years now.
Robert, is there political will in Washington, in the administration, in Congress, for such a change maybe in posture towards Iran on the part of the U.S.?
Well, there might be in Congress. I'm not sure there is in the administration because, you know, this is very unscientific, but this is an election year. And a wide-ranging war in the Middle East may not help the Biden administration or would probably hurt it. So I think that, you know, in our system, the commander-in-chief makes the calls. All the powerful experts can give him this advice and that, but he has to make the judgment call. And I think he's ultimately fixated on getting reelected and doesn't want a wide-ranging war with Iran. But, you know, that being off the table, they have to really ramp up the level and ferocity of the attacks on Iranian proxies from Syria in the north to Yemen in the south.
Robert, what do you think the Israelis will do in the coming days, weeks, as it relates to their efforts in Gaza? I mean, the response was stronger probably than maybe a lot of people thought, but it's been certainly consistent with what they've said. They said they are going to wipe out Hamas, and a lot of people question whether that's even possible. What do they do from here, do you think?
All right. Well, the problem the Israelis have is if they have a permanent ceasefire that allows in massive amounts of rebuilding and humanitarian aid, the way that Gaza society is structured is that the remnants of Hamas will take that aid and re-strengthen themselves. You know, humanitarian aid is one thing, but rebuilding aid will be stolen by Hamas, and then the Israelis will not be back to square one, but they'll be back a number of steps. Therefore, I think the Israelis will do everything to keep putting off American pressure, saying nice things to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, but ultimately to keep pressing on and fighting. Yes, there might be a ceasefire for a few weeks to get back maybe 100 hostages, because Netanyahu is under a lot of domestic pressure to get more hostages released. But in the medium term, right, and the long term, I think they keep bombing. Though it will shift from these sort of, you know, I wouldn't call it indiscriminate, but these wide-ranging attacks on infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, and change to intelligence-driven, targeted, attacks. We get intelligence that these people are in such and such a building, we bomb it. And they will keep doing that, and they will keep methodically going after the tunnels, flooding them with seawater, et cetera. You know, the media loves novelty, and there isn't a lot of novelty after you accept that the Israelis are bombing and flooding the tunnels. It just takes time. It takes many weeks. So the media thinks Israel is not making progress, but that's false.
Robert Kaplan with us, folks. He will continue with us. Robert T. Kaplan, I can't say enough about his effort over the years. The Loom of Time was my book of the year. I just can't say enough about the span from Morocco to the stands. Robert Kaplan, I've got to go back, because of the shock of our military at risk, to the state of the Pacific, the jewel from years ago, Asia's cauldron, the South China Sea, and the end of a stable Pacific. We walked away from the Pacific Rim. Now we're coming back with four military bases sprawled across the Philippines, the debate of Taiwan. Give us an update on how you perceive the end of a stable Pacific.
All right. First of all, the Chinese love to, you know, to constantly bully and push around the Philippines, because the Philippines is a weak state compared to the other major states in the Pacific. But it is also a treaty ally, the highest form of ally with the United States. So whenever China bullies around the Philippines, Beijing is also poking Washington in the eye. I think what we've seen is the creation of this wall of sand, where the Chinese have literally dumped sand, created atolls, built military bases in a very, in a very slow-moving fashion, in salami-sliced fashion, so that gradually, over the last decade since I published Asia's Cauldron, the Chinese have essentially taken over the South China Sea without the United States being able to do much. It's been, you know, they've done it by a thousand cuts, and each one so small that for us to retaliate, we would seem seem to be over retaliating.
I'm going
to
cut in here because I know Paul wants to jump in. One final question on that. If it's been by 1,000 cuts, what are their 1,000 cuts as it relates to Taiwan?
Remember, Taiwan is the northern border of the South China Sea. It is the cork in the bottle of the South China Sea. So by taking over the South China Sea, China makes tremendous progress in enveloping and making an end run around Taiwanese sovereignty.
Robert, we've seen economic data coming out of China much weaker than maybe people would have expected with the reopening of that economy. How does that change maybe the calculus of President Xi as he thinks about the positioning of China in that part of the world, also vis-a-vis the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, when you have a big authoritarian state that is economically weaker, but militarily stronger and becoming stronger and stronger, like China, that's a very dangerous situation because the regime can always be tempted to kind of distract its population with nationalist posturing, especially if that population isn't producing enough, you know, if that economy is not producing enough jobs, especially for young males, yep, et cetera. So I think like an economically fragile China going forward, with even as China is producing more nuclear weapons, more warships, more submarine, more nuclear powered submarines, most important thing of all, I think it's a very tense situation. The combination of those two factors.
Yep. And I guess, from the technology standpoint, it really feels like there's a technology cold war between China and the West. What do you think the U.S. posture should be politically, policy-wise, towards China over the next several years?
Look, we have to avoid at all costs a major hot war in the Pacific. The markets around the world have absorbed in very well 25 years of warfare in the Middle East. They've absorbed warfare in Ukraine. They've made adjustments. They've priced it in. But a hot, high-end war in the Pacific would be like COVID-19. It would be like an extinction-level event for a period of time for markets. Right. It would disrupt supply chains in a big way and all of that. So how do you avoid a hot war? Well, you get to what I call a post-Cuban missile crisis situation. The Cuban missile crisis, both superpowers stared into the abyss and they were absolutely terrified. And afterwards, you got the hotline established, nuclear arms limitation talks, nuclear test ban treaty, ultimately detente. That's what we have to get to with China without having a Cuban missile crisis.
Dr. Kaplan, I'm running out of time. Robert T. Kaplan, as simple as I can make it, do we have a foreign policy now? After the tumult of the last X number of years of presidential politics, all that's going on in Washington, whatever anybody's political affiliation, do you see a foreign policy in this nation?
I do, but I see it be in danger of changing by 180 degrees every 4 years. We don't have the continuity of a foreign policy the way we used to have.
Mm-hmm. Got to leave it there. Robert Kaplan, thank you so much, folks. I'll put it out on LinkedIn and Twitter. It is my book of the year, The Loom of Time. Lisa Mateo with our headlines. Lisa, what do you start with?
All right, we're starting with the Wall Street Journal. Paul, this is over to you. It may entice you to go electric. Okay, listen to this. There's a German tech startup. It's called Finn, and it has a 6 to 18 month subscription service. So it's letting people rent EVs. So you can kind of test them out, kick the tires, see what you think. It has about 25,000 subscribers. Now, 40% of those went on to buy the EVs after because they like driving it. So they have them mostly in Germany, but they do have about 2,000 subscribers here on the East Coast. So just over, Americans are not as willing to buy, but just over 7% of its American customers went on to buy the EV. So this is just another venue. I mean, Hertz tried it. It didn't kind of work out.
I know. Matt Miller, who got me a 1 week test drive of the Ford F-150 Lightning, and it was awesome vehicle. And I'm not a pickup truck guy because I'm a Wall Street guy. I don't drive pickups. But it was awesome. But the charging anxiety is there.
Where did you...
Plus it was $4,000.
We're going to stop the show now worldwide because this is what I hear from everybody over beverages of my choice. So you get the car from Miller, the Ford dealer, whatever.
Yeah, he's a player.
Where did you charge it?
I charged it at Bloomberg's Princeton offices, actually.
You drove to Princeton?
No, I was down there for a meeting. I figured I'd charge it up and boom. And at my country club in New Jersey, they have charging stations there. So, but otherwise...
Can you charge it at your house?
No, it would take 24 hours.
You have to buy it.
It would take 24 hours with my little 120-volt...
Full disclosure, and I don't even have a driver's license, folks. That's how qualified I am.
Tom does not have a driveway.
I'm doing a hybrid. Like Bentley, it's working. What's next? You're killing me. It takes how long to charge it?
Well, if you don't have the big charger thing...
30 minutes? Yeah.
If you have the big charger thing, then it's pretty quick, a number of hours. But you got to drive around and look for it. I don't know.
Next.
It's a lot. Okay. We're going to Bloomberg now. A lot of layoff news. So Bloomberg took a look at who is most likely to get fired. Okay. So they interviewed economists, recruiters, consultants, career coaches. Turns out middle managers, remote workers. Because middle managers, people trying to streamline, companies trying to streamline, remote because...
You mean work from home?
Yes, correct. Remote because, you know, they want more people back in the office. And it's easier to let go of someone remotely than in person.
So they didn't mention people with a red and blue bow tie.
No, not exactly.
You know what I'm wearing today? Claudia Sahm was busting my chops. She tore me to shreds out on social yesterday. I'm wearing a red and blue bow tie for Dr. Sahm today. What do you think? I think you mentioned UPS yesterday.
I know.
6 days a week. They want you in the office.
I know. Everybody's got to come in.
Okay, quickly, or one more. You got 20 seconds. Go.
20 seconds. All right. Walt Disney parents going crazy. They're taking classes about these paid reservation systems, travel agents, YouTubers, influencers. It's all the lengths that parents are going to book Disney vacations. It's
just to get goofy for breakfast.
Just to get it. Yep. Yes.
Want to do is spend $200 to get a warmed over pancake so Princess can see Goofy.
There you go.
And I've actually done this.
Yes.
Ken Foley, have you done this with the twins? I mean, have you been in the breakfast?
I've
done Goofy?
I've never done Disney with the kids. Four kids, zero Disney.
Are you serious?
Yes, how about that?
We're only doing this for
a merit badge for that.
The truth of the matter is Lisa Mateo had a Bon Jovi poster in her bedroom, and so did Denise.
Yes.
Denise from the upper West Side had Bon Jovi. Bon Jovi, we're all Bon Jovi today for Paul Sweeney.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.